Okay, the first assignment that I put online was chapter 2 in Character is Destiny. There are really only three things that I want to point out. On page 15, Russell Goh talks about a famous quotation from Socrates, 4th century BC philosopher in ancient Athens. Second paragraph, Socrates made provocative remarks like his famous quotation, "The unexamined life is not worth living." And this is, Dr. Goh mentioned, several years after the death of Heraclitus, a fellow who said, "Character is destiny." What he had in mind is that whatever has become habitual for you as your character and has become part of who you are and how you live, your character, if it's a good character or a bad character, the things that happen to you during the course of life, your character will play out. And in the end, you'll be able to look back on the life of a person and see that you could have predicted in the beginning, on the basis of their character, strong or weak, that that's how things were going to turn out. That's why Heraclitus said, "Character is destiny." Heraclitus was famous for talking about the fact that events in the world are chaotic. We don't have ultimate control over our lives or over the situation. But in spite of the fact that he was convinced that that is the nature of the world, when it came to ourselves as individual moral agents, whatever our character is, will play out, and you'll struggle with the difficulties and overcome them on the basis of the strength of character and the strength of the kind of courage that comes with strong character. Your ability to live life fully, it depends on your character. And Goh is saying that several years after Heraclitus died, Socrates was around saying things like, "The unexamined life is not worth living." And Goh is mentioning Socrates was encouraging those of Athens and all of us who have followed since his time to avoid falling into the trap of ethical complacency, where we get to the point where we stop trying to become a better person. And there's a lot in this that carries over to Christianity. Christianity deals with the reality of things, and these are the reality of things that are being pointed out. So what carries over? I would put it like this. Without effort, there is no spiritual movement in the right direction. The fathers would say, we are always moving spiritually. We are either moving toward God, we are either traveling the path of life, or we are traveling the path of death. There is no standing still. We're always moving one way or the other. And so if we become complacent, if we just kind of let things go, we can predict which way they're going to go. Things are going to get worse and worse. We're not certainly going to develop good character, and our life will slide. It takes spiritual effort to become a better person. It takes the examination of ourselves to make life worth living. Father Schmemann used to say, after a stupid life comes a stupid death. So if we just drift, our lives will have no meaning. And if our lives are going to have meaning, and people have always known this, you know, we are going to have to reflect on what we are doing and intentionally choose to go in a positive direction. That is fundamental truth. On the next page, page 16, Goh points out that the first and most important part of examining our lives from an ethical point of view, appreciating the importance of ethics in our own everyday lives, is being honest about and taking responsibility for what one is as a free, moral, and adult human being. This is something that we have to learn or be taught. We can be taught. The Greeks believed that human beings needed to have a certain kind of education in the moral life. Is it possible to teach someone how to live a good life? Well, the Greeks believed that it was. You follow the path of virtue, do things that are good and noble and just, and by doing them repeatedly, you develop a stronger and stronger character. So, taking responsibility for your own life, that's something that will hopefully come once you reach adulthood in terms of biology and age, and then, on the strength of the character that's been developed, you'll be able to move on. But whether that's happened or whether it hasn't, in the end, we have to take responsibility for what we are as free, moral, adult human beings. I'm just going to read the rest of this section. With his marked emphasis on honest, ethical self-examination, Socrates was echoing a sacred two-word principle known to every person in the ancient Greek world, Know Thyself was etched into the marble over the entrance into the temple of Apollo at Delphi, which the Greeks thought of as being the holiest of all their religious sites. Socrates was not merely, Ghost says, echoing this principle. He transformed the meaning of this principle, because before Socrates it had another lesser, less important, less vital meaning. And here lies not only the brilliance of Socrates' teaching and example, but also an essential starting point for our looking in the mirror discussion. As Christians, if we are going to come to confession and make a confession that is transforming, that involves turning around from the movement away from Christ that we're trying to accomplish, that's supposed to be the event of transformation in confession, we have to become aware of what we're doing. And the monks in the Orthodox Christian tradition will emphasize that awareness, self-knowledge, in the sense of being aware of what we have been doing and how it matches up with what we ought to be doing, is critical. Before the time of Socrates, the conventional interpretation of that motto that was carved into the temple of Delphi, "Know Thyself," meant something along these lines. Know your place, your status in society, your duties in society, and be true to them. Don't try to move into a position in society that is higher than yours.
Not very American.
No, it's not. Know your station, know your place. The British in the 19th century for sure would still agree with this. It's the principle that has held India together for thousands of years. The caste system is only a kind of institutionalized and structural example of it. So this is a kind of an early mechanism that held societies together. Interesting things were happening in the 4th century BC, one of which was Socrates' questioning of this interpretation. And one of Socrates' greatest and most enduring legacies, for which he ultimately gave his life because he would not abandon it, was to transform the meaning of "know thyself" by turning it inward. Socrates was saying that we ought to examine our lives, know ourselves as we actually are within ourselves, and give far less time and attention to our outside external circumstances like social status and wealth, and to spend much more time and attention on the things that matter most, internal goals like wisdom, truth, and ethical character. So, know thyself, a principle of wisdom that is foundational for us as Christians. A problem is pointed out at the very end of this chapter, on page 21. You cannot master yourself if you do not understand yourself. There are mirrors for the face. We can look in a mirror and see what we look like. But the only mirror for the spirit is wise self-reflection. And one of the things that I want to encourage is reflection. Because the things that we're trying to focus on are not matters of learning facts. They're not a matter of learning information and fitting that information into a way of understanding the world that we might already have. It's necessary for us to question ourselves. Socrates had that down solid. The question is, do you know yourself? It takes an effort for us to know ourselves. We as Christians certainly would agree with that. When you stop caring about your outer image and try to amend, that is to change and improve who you are within yourself, if you're going to do that and be able to gauge how wise have you been in your choosing the best things, if you're going to learn to judge how well you measure up to moral and spiritual excellence, we have to understand what we've got within us, what's going on inside of us. It is always uncomfortable. As Christians, we know that it's no fun to go to confession. But if you drift, if you don't make the spiritual effort, you will not somehow automatically move toward Christ. There's no question about that. The idea that somehow God is going to zap us with good character, or God is going to zap us with virtues, is just not in the nature of things. God didn't create us that way, and it's so objectively true that every traditional culture has discovered that it is necessary for us to take on the task ourselves to actively strengthen our character. Questions, comments on those excerpts from Character's Destiny?
Is there any danger in the idea of know yourself? I mean, is there anything that's not orthodox about it? I mean, in the sense that, is there anything vain in that? I mean, that's a question. I'm just, curious.
There are vain ways that we could pursue it. There's always the possibility of our deceiving ourselves, but if we're deceiving ourselves, then we don't know ourselves.
It requires reflection plus honesty.
Right? Oh, sure, yeah. If we look at the world in its broken condition, and we accept that is the way things are. And we look at ourselves in our broken condition and we say to ourselves, this is the way I am. Then if we throw away character's destiny, that's for sure. I am the way I am. God created me this way. That's just your nature. Well, what nature is that? Well, as far as Christians are concerned, that is your fallen nature. Maintain that status quo, and you are simply a prisoner of death. Christianity, by its nature, rebels against being imprisoned in the condition in which we find ourselves. We're told that heaven needs to be taken by force. We need to be active. We need to do something. The idea that we could somehow be passive, God's in his heaven and all is right with the world, and the way things are is the way they ought to be because God created things the way they're supposed to be. God made me the way I am, so that I really have nothing to do actively. It directly contradicts teachings that are in the New Testament, teachings of Jesus. The next thing that I want to look at is page 22 from Steps of Transformation, chapter 1. Almost everything said in the context of alcoholism can be transferred with little effort to other addictions and addictive behaviors, as opposed to habits, which are either chosen by your parents who are trying to raise you to have good character, or we can choose them ourselves. What if our parents weren't kind enough as to build good character in us? Well, you can choose this sort of thing yourself. The whole tradition of advice offered to people as to how to develop good character wouldn't exist if having good character depended on society or your parents developing good character, and then if that didn't happen, you have no hope. Obviously, the idea is that we can decide that our life is not going well and that we need to intentionally establish good character so that we have good moral habits, work habits. If we haven't developed them in youth, we have to develop them intentionally. We may find, as we make the effort to know ourselves, we may discover addictions within ourselves that are controlling us, that we are enslaved to. So, as I've mentioned before, this text can be helpful in order to address those addictions, to provide insight for all men and women. In the next paragraph, he says, what Alcoholics Anonymous, or a STEP program of this kind, offers is sobriety. And it does so to anyone who has a desire to stop. And I want to move on to a definition of sobriety, because this term sobriety for an alcoholic or for an addict, when we're not actively doing it, we're sober. So you are a sober alcoholic. AA will point out that alcoholism cannot be cured. You never reach the point where you're going to stop being an alcoholic. That's one meaning of sobriety, a dry alcoholic. The other meaning is very important in the Orthodox Christian spiritual tradition. Sobriety is one of the central virtues of the monastic tradition, the spiritual tradition, not just for monks, but for all of us. It's one of the things that is most highly valued. When an Orthodox priest or monk refers to someone as a person of deep sobriety, it is one of the deepest compliments that you can possibly get. What is the definition of sobriety within that tradition? I have a definition of sobriety that was given by Hezekias of Jerusalem, who was a famous priest and monk, well known in the 5th century, a famous catechist, teacher of those who were becoming Christian. He was a priest in the Church of Jerusalem, famous biblical commentator and preacher. And he gives a very good definition of sobriety in this spiritual sense. Sobriety, he says, is the steadfast setting up of the thought of the mind and posting it at the door of the heart. Now, there is a similarity here to the way Go and teachers of the ancient wisdom tradition talk about character, something that you intentionally practice. It becomes a habit of your action. Sobriety is something that you intentionally do, that you intentionally embrace. It's a virtue that you strive for. You post this conscious rejection of living a life that is contrary to the virtuous life in Christ. He says you post this sober refusal to be drunk on the passions and desires. You post it at the door of the heart so that the mind sees alien thoughts as they come. So it's watchfulness of thoughts. Those thieves and robbers, he calls them. Alien thoughts. Alien to what? Alien to a life like the life of Christ. Alien to a life like the life that we are meant, each one of us, to live if we're going to be truly ourselves. our sober mind hears what these destroyers say and do, notices when they tempt us, and sees what the meaning is of these thoughts as they arise and where they're going to take us, recognizing that these things are supplied by the enemy, demons, who are trying to seduce our minds by fantasy. A priest sometimes will say, did you entertain this? Whatever it was, a temptation to lift something from Walmart, tempted to do something, and we can play with it. We can imagine, well, this, I really could use this fishing rod. Fishing rod's not such good. It says collapsible fishing rod would have to be to get it out of the store. Just imagine ourselves using the fishing rod out there on a stream. We are playing with it. We're not rejecting it. A sober mind would immediately cut it off. Not toy with it, not play with it, not be seduced by fantasy. For this work of maintaining a steadfast, sober mind, when it is done with loving effort, not to try to beat ourselves up and say, you terrible person to even think about walking out with this fishing rod. You go in the other direction and you don't play with the thoughts. You just keep moving. We're always moving in one direction or another. If we begin down the fantasy path of imagining how great it would be to have this rod, you know, out there on the stream side, we are moving already. At that point, it would take a lot more effort to turn around and go the other way at that point. If we don't allow ourselves to be seduced by the fantasy, but we, with a loving effort, you see, not violently by condemning ourselves, we move in the other direction. When this work of sobriety and maintaining a sober mind is done, it reveals to us very fundamentally and clearly by experience the art of mental war. We understand by practice what spiritual struggle within ourselves is all about. And the more we do this, the better we get at it. By experience, we learn the art of mental war and bring skill in it. So we come to know ourselves in a way that goes beyond even what Socrates is talking about, because now we are learning to know ourselves. We're tempted by certain things more, other things less. How do we deal with that? Keeping watchfulness on ourselves and developing a steadfast thought of the mind, developing sobriety. It's like an inward spiritual character. There are virtues involved. The reason I point that out is very important in ascending the heights. So we have two kinds of sobriety. One is literal, to not be drunk. Drink alcohol, use drugs, you're drunk. Don't drink alcohol, don't use drugs. You don't get drunk, you don't get high, you are sober. So that's a literal meaning. Usually what people would say is, well, there's the literal meaning and then there is the symbolic or figurative meaning. Which is more real? Well, the literal meaning is more real. Orthodox would say there is the literal meaning, which you have to understand in order to understand the fullest meaning of what you're dealing with. And there is also the real meaning, the meaning at the level of actual reality. Because according to our understanding, this physical world, as it is in its broken condition, and ourselves, messed up as we are, if you just stay at that level and think of the world in its brokenness as it is, and ourselves as we are, that is literally what the world is. It is literally what we are, but actually the world is more than that. There is a reality that is more permanent, that is more lasting with respect to the world and with respect to ourselves as well. There is a reality that is who we really are, who God created us to be. And we are already that person in a sense. It's just that we are not doing that person. We are not living that life. We are not doing that life. So sobriety means not just the literal meaning of not being drunk. Sobriety means not losing who we actually are. Not falling prey to fantasy, not falling prey to passions, which will delude us and lead us into an unreal world, but maintain our establishment in the actual realities of spiritual life. Because, you know, they're not figurative, you see, they're not symbolic. That's the real reality. That's who we really are. By maintaining our sobriety, we see things as they actually are, and we deal with the temptations. So you have a literal meaning of sobriety, to be drunk, but the meaning of sobriety in the spiritual tradition of Orthodox Christianity takes into account the way things actually are, the way the world was created by God to be, the way he has reestablished it in himself, and the way we actually are. That's what we don't want to lose. when we get to Ascending the Heights, there is another point very closely related to that where there is a similar situation. One phrase, fear of death, the literal meaning of fear of death is to fear that our physical life is going to come to an end. That's fear of death. There is another sense of fear of death. Our life is in Christ. We have, according to St. Paul, died to a life separate from God. We have died in the old Adam sort of way. Our life is in Christ. It has always been true. As we are created, our life is by communion with God. Anything else is death. If we fear to lose that life, that's the fear of death too. And in a more real way than just the fear of the loss of our physical lives. The martyrs went to their death. They had no fear of that merely physical death. Their fear was for the loss of their life in Christ, because that's true life. It is permanent. It is eternal. It fulfills the way God created us to be. That's our real life. Betraying that is death. Now, if we fear the death of our life in Christ, we're in a good place. And that's what we'll be dealing with in Ascending the Heights. It's very similar to what we talked about before with respect to sobriety. The literal meaning and the meaning at the level of the reality of things, how things actually are. Real sobriety, not becoming drunk on the passions within ourselves. Fear of the death of our real life, our life at one with God. That's what we need to guard against. Anything that will put that life to an end. So you see, we're going to make the transition from taking this world as it is and ourselves as we are, as the norm, make the transition from that to understanding a spiritual text like Ascending the Heights. We have to make those kinds of deepenings of our understanding of terms like sobriety and fear of death.
Oh, no, I have three more questions. So are the desires coming from our heart? What I'm trying to, I guess my question is, which direction are the desires? Stealing the fishing rod coming out of my head? Or is it coming from my heart, my desires from my heart, and so that I filter them through my mind? Or are they from my mind and I'm guarding my heart?
You can only be guarding your heart if your heart is already in a condition to be guarded. Jesus says that we act out of what is in our heart.
Right.
Well, hopefully, what is in our heart is the love of God, a faithfulness to Christ. The point is, and this will come up again soon, we have to guard that. We are baptized. We are chrismated. We enter the life in Christ. But that life has got to be guarded, or we will betray it.
So the being the signpost is protecting the heart.
Yes.
In this situation.
The assumption is that the
temptation of wondering, hey, I wonder if I could get away with getting that fishing rod. No,
right.
I'm not going to do that.
Well,
once I reach out and put that fishing rod in my jacket and start to steal it, that I've taken that action and brought it into my heart, so to speak.
That's true. The enemy will try to seduce you through your mind and your imagination and corrupt your heart. Once your heart is corrupted, then it may be the desire of your heart to take fishing rods, get whatever you can, do bad things to other people to make yourself feel better. Yeah, that comes from the heart. The problem is the condition of your heart is in bad shape. But you go to all the effort, come to confession, and you confess the things that are foreign to you because they are not Christ-like, and you restore your baptism. From that point on, when the priest says, go and sin no more, it doesn't mean go out and don't break any more rules like you did last time. What he means is go out and guard your heart. But yeah, your mind, the imaginations of your mind will come from that direction into your heart if you accept them. So you guard to keep that from happening.
But it might also not just come from your mind, it comes from your body, as in maybe it's not so much stealing a fishing rod, maybe it's like, I'm tired, I don't want to get out of church today.
That's true.